wherever you are, to the online forum, the role of NGOs in the course of human civilization. This online forum is jointly initiated and organized by Urban Forum and Sinopress. Both representatives are with us today. My name is Alice Schmatzberger. I'm founder of China Culture Desk, a platform based in Vienna. I will be your moderator of the day and I will guide you through today's agenda. Yeah, let me please also remind you that all your mics are turned to mute as long as you are not speaking. So otherwise we would have some interaction with all the voices. Yeah, as I mentioned, the topic of our online forum today is the role of NGOs in the course of human civilization, and we are happy to address the following topics. Problems in protecting human rights under international humanitarian law. Definition and realization of human rights. The role of cultural differences in interpreting human rights. Dualism versus universalism. Security questions and human rights. Hegemonial power and double moral standards. The role of NGOs in protecting human rights and the role of NGOs in better serving the cause of humanity. And we are honored to have the following distinguished panelists with us today. I will shortly introduce their names and organizations. We have as our keynote speaker today, Professor Mehmet Şükrü-Güzel. Then we have Dr. Laszlo Flam from Europa House Budapest, Dr. Anat Hochberg-Marom, strategic consultant from Israel, Magister David Keinrath, representing Österreichisch-Weißrussische Gesellschaft, Magister Otto Kölbl from Switzerland, Dr. Ernst Löschner, representing Alpine Peace Crossing Austria, and Mr. Hermann Kreuher from UNCAF, that means United Nations Correspondence Association Vienna. And as I mentioned before, we have with us representing the organizer, Magister Bernhard Müller from Urban Forum and Magister Helena Chang from Sinopress. Let me welcome everybody. Yeah, as you might realize, we have a rather tight schedule today. So please let me remind all the panelists to take into account the time constraints, approximately 5 to 6 minutes for each panelist and approximately 10 minutes for our keynote speaker, so that we are able to address all the topics and that every panelist has the chance to present his or her considerations. Let me thank you in advance for this. Yeah, we would now move on to our first keynote speaker. This is Professor Mehmet Şükrü-Güzel. He is founder and president of the Center for Peace and Reconciliation Studies. He is an experienced expert on finding legal solutions to regional conflicts from Iraq to Myanmar, from Cyprus to West Papua. Are you with us already?
Yes.
Yes? Okay, your microphone is turned on. Perfect.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. It's all okay. Okay, Professor Güzel is going to share with us his reflections on what are the most important human rights for war-torn countries such as Iraq or Syria, as well as the people of developing countries in Asia and Africa. How is it comparing to the needs of people in their developed countries? Please, Professor Güzel, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. And also, I would like to mention one thing. My degree of Professor Dr. is honoris causa. I've got a honorable degree of this title from the University of International Academy of Science from Azerbaijan. When we turn to the question, I mean, let me begin from the first part. What are the most important human rights for war-torn countries such as Iraq and Syria? When we talk about the most important human rights in a war-torn country of a non-international armed conflict, here the examples are non-international armed conflict, we are talking about a place that has been badly damaged by a war that involves different groups from the same country. And today, Iraq and Syria are under the definition of war-torn country in which armed conflicts are still going on between various groups. But if we ask the question, which are the most important human rights in Iraq and Syria for the people as well, for this is valid for Afghanistan, the answer doesn't depend on the will of the people. The answer is subject to not only the state, but as well the will to warrior parties, that is the will of the non-state armed groups, designated as terrorists or not, to carry out the basic human rights, and the obligation of the non-state armed groups arising from the concerned international law. The important part is the responsibility of the non-state armed groups here comes from the territory that they control and they administer. And this is not a group of military group that do not control any territory. And in an ongoing armed conflict, people are the passive element. Their will for human rights are only subject to what are to be given to them. In this sense, the international obligations of the non-state armed groups on human rights during an ongoing armed conflict is the key factor. And we have to understand also one more additional thing. When the non-state armed groups control a territory, they create a kind of regime, and this regime must be subject to the some obligations, and this is how we define them, designated as terrorists or not. I mean, I can just give an example with the UN Security Council Resolution 2020. Now, Taliban is a recognized non-state armed group, not designated as terrorists. So when they control a territory, they've got some obligations, but I think Taliban has a missing point to understand all these things and thinks that they achieve something as a victorious. And the applicability of human rights for armed conflict has been the subject of extensive discussion over the past decade. And one of the reasons of that is that during the dirty periods of Cold War till 1994, unfortunately, inside the UN, some so-called self-defined national liberation movements think themselves as if they've got a right to kill civilians. And this was unfortunately valid and legal in the UN system till the UN Declaration on Measures to Eliminate International Terrorism. Because till 1994, the Convention on Civil and Political Rights are accepted only to be bound by the states, not by the state armed groups. I can give an interesting example from my own experience inside the UN during the human rights sessions. I participated in a side event, and the title was the enforced disappearances. And I also mentioned the responsibility of non-state armed groups for the enforced disappearances for the territory they control. And I don't want to give the name, but a recognized another non-state armed group by the UN representative, believe me, of talking in the name of the states. And unfortunately, still inside the UN, there are some few groups, things that recognize non-state armed groups are not owned by any international obligation. And when we come to the point, other than international humanitarian law, when the states, non-state armed groups control the territories, we have got the main instrument, that is the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights. Other than Article 4, which organized the derogation, the ICCPR clearly specifies that certain rights are non-derogable, which means they cannot be suspended even in times of emergency. I mean, no derogation for right to life, this is as well mentioned by the international humanitarian law, but this can go up to their freedom of speech and their right to recognize before the law, freedom of thought and religion. And this is in fact originated for the territory in accordance with the idea that human rights protection devolves with the territory. Inevitability of the human rights victim must be in a position to seek redress for the violations and abuses of their rights. I mean, this is the important point of all the time. We have got, because we have got a huge problem of impunity. And also there is a gap when we talk about the second part of the question, the people of developing countries in Asia, Asia and Africa, and how it's compared to the needs of the people in the developed countries. I mean, this is an interesting point because When we look of the evaluation of the two important conventions, there is a difference between the developing countries, mostly decolonized countries after the Second World War. For a long period of time, argued that the most important human rights in the developing countries are the economic rights, to basic needs, which are more important than civil and political rights. And according to developing countries, civil and political rights can wait until the basic economic needs are secured. And the developed countries are more interested in the protection and advancement of civil and political rights, as opposed to the developing countries. And this is why this division led to adaptation of two separate conventions. ICCPR, as I mentioned, it is accepted as the first generation of rights. And the second one for the developing countries, International Convention on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. And it is accepted by in classic literature, the second generation rights. And then we come to solidarity rights, third generation rights, such as the right to develop, right to peace, right to health. But the relation between human rights and the development is essential, is indicated as the third generation rights. And the first concerns between the ICCPR and the International Convention on Economic and Social and Cultural Rights, that means between the developing countries and the developed countries, is achieved by the Declaration on the Right to Development adopted by the UN General Assembly in 1986. I mean, this is nearly time, it comes nearly at the end of the Cold War. And in Article 1, the defines right to development is an inalienable human right by virtue of which every human person and all peoples are entitled to participate in, contribute to, and enjoy economic, social, cultural, and political development, in which all human rights and fundamental freedoms can be realized. I mean, this council is the critical point. And then when we come, Millennium Development Rights is the last achievement for this, but we have to look on the other point. When the people in the developing countries, I mean, the original, for example, why I am living in Switzerland, there is no corruption. It is not because of the people are different than the people in Asia, Africa, or even in my country from Turkey. But they believe that their future is guaranteed. And then when we look at from the perspective of the peoples, preventing corruption in the government can be the basic, but corruption is most of the time is not the choice of the corrupt people. The reason is the fear of bureaucrats for their future, and this is how corruption becomes, and then the realization of open society is preventing. Then for the economic development, then we can see that if there is no social and political rights, there cannot be a development. And what we can say is that, on the other hand, realization of human rights means the need of economic power, especially on social security system. The advancements of human rights are subject to sustainability of the economic powers of the developed state. In this sense, the growing economies of the developing countries is a threat for the continuity of not only the life standards of the peoples in the developed countries, but as well the future of the social security for the developed countries. This is the reality for European Union. And maybe in the coming 20 years, the European Union's economic power and political power in the world will decrease. And when there is a decrease on the economic power, and especially for the social security, then problems create enemies. And when the social psychology has fears for the future, it affects the political psychology of the people in the developed countries. And this can easily, as we can see from today, to be a hatred against immigration, refugees, and racism as the most serious challenges to human rights in the developed countries. I mean, the rising of the racist and neo-Nazi political parties is from today a threat to developed countries, subject to the decline of the economic power of the developed countries. And we can see very well from the speech of the ex-president of the United States, President Trump, and he created a kind of hate speech for the immigrants. It was a little bit funny for a settler colony state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Güzel, for your considerations. Let me shortly sum up a bit. You were talking about that human rights are definitely applicable in times of conflict and war. There are first, second, and third generation human rights. You were also talking about that the difference between developed countries and developing countries. So the most important human rights for developing country is the economic rights to fulfill the basic needs. So this is priority versus developed countries. They focus more on civil and political rights. You were also talking about preventing corruption would be one of the first basic steps. You were also talking about the Millennial Development Goals. And you mentioned also history, colonialism. That means developing countries developed at other countries' expenses. And that with the rise of the developing countries, there are still challenges that remain. I hope I got it right for summing up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your considerations. We will come back to you for the second keynote in a couple of times. Yeah, following the statements of Professor Gissel, let us now start our first round of discussion. Our first panelist will be Dr. Laszlo Flam from Europa House Budapest. Are you with us already? Yeah, can you hear me? Okay, microphone is turned on. Please, Mr. Flam, as was pointed out by Professor Gissel, development was a result of preventing the development of others. How do you see the hegemonial power and the double moral standard in the post-colonial era influencing the reality of human rights? Please, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I would like to first ask, can everybody hear me?
Sounds good.
Yeah, first I have to make a note that this is a very complex issue, so we have very limited time to discuss. And I would like to just make some maybe provoking new approaches to this issue, and this could be very good for the next round of the discussion round. So in my view, the hegemonial power and double moral standards today, when we talk about in context of human rights, have been put again into the clash of civilizations. As you remember, a very famous scientist, Samuel Huntington, about his favorite, very famous work and my favorite reading about Clash of Civilization came out 1996 around, and then it's 25 years later. I think this theory has been revitalized again. It gained more and more importance. What I'm talking about, I think that a human rights issue has become again a part of power politics. Power politics and clash of civilizations today. If we put this approach into the present situation, we have to talk about the Western world relationship to the developing countries, the Asian civilizations like India and China. And my impression is that NGOs dealing with protection of international human rights, they become tool of power politics and that of communication of double moral standards. Developed countries see some very negative trends in context of protection of human rights in developing countries. And we have lots of background about it. We can talk about trade. We can talk about the pandemic. And it raises also a question that the reality of human rights, how does it look like today? Protection of international human rights, as I said, is part of power politics. And it also has a negative trend that it communicates very biased, sometimes very biased picture about the state and situation of human rights in developing countries. I would like to say that nowadays we should consider how NGOs can make a new innovative contribution to the state of international human rights. They are very twisted situation in my view. A big group, certain group of international civil organization communicate a biased picture view about this issue, the international human rights, and other NGOs, they would like to communicate some alternative views about the international human rights. And the international media and also the citizens in Europe and outside Europe, they feel sometimes very confusing. So what is the real situation, the reality of human rights today and where? So as I said, this biased communication not only directed to developing countries, it's also directed to developed countries. I don't want to mention concretely names of countries, but we should understand that if you talk about developing countries, some of them are parts of the ancient civilization, and we talk about civilizations, and these ancient civilizations are much older than the Western type of civilization. And these civilizations, including countries, they have a different view on set of principles. But in the Western world, we know principles, including the protection of political rights, human rights, economic rights, and so on. And this different set of principles today are more and more influencing this very biased communication on human rights, and the double moral standards approach is more and more obvious today to see in the international politics. So I would like to just say that the civilization related aspects should be also we should also consider it by discussing this topic. Second, are NGOs, can NGOs be able to, for example, create something new in order to overbridge, to manage this biased communication of international human rights to the world? What does it mean to have a new role or communication for NGOs by fulfilling this task? For example, maybe to create a new value category, or new value categories for protecting human rights. And these new value categories could be based on the civilization related aspects. And are international NGOs able to develop this kind of new value categories, which are, of course, can be part of power politics, but out of the space of power capacities, can these new value categories be put into motion? And of course, the pandemic times has already changed a many things around us, attitudes, thinking, mindsets, also in politics and power politics. And these new changes in the pandemic times, are these new changes a possibility, a unique possibility, opportunity for international NGOs to reconsider the traditional approach, I would like to say Western approach to protection of human rights, or it will turn into new rounds of conflicts. So I would say that in this hard situation as we have today, international NGOs should generate some new innovative input contribution to the protection of international human rights by avoiding the double moral standards. Of course, how can we do it if lots of NGOs are part of, so to say, industry based on communicating double moral standards? So thank you very much. And I hope we can also continue with this line in the next discussion round.
Thank you very much, Dr. Flam, for your very clear considerations on the role of NGOs, on the biased reporting, and also on the challenges which our NGOs facing if they want to play a positive role in future. Some of the aspects you have mentioned, I think they are going to be addressed by other panelists in the course of the following presentations. Thank you very much. Yeah, let's move on to our next speaker. Our next panelist will be Dr. Anat Hochberg-Maron from Israel. Are you with us?
Yes, hi, thank you very much.
Thank you for being there, for joining us. My first question to you would be, how do you view the conflicts between security and human rights?
Okay, so I just want to thank you very much for inviting me for this room, for this forum. And I've just written a very short file that I'm going to read it from the paper, if you don't mind, and I just answer you. The connection between security individual and the protection of human rights is an actual theme that has significantly intensified during the last decade. The conflict between the security and human rights we meet today pose serious protection challenges to the peace and security of the international community. In general, security of the person is a basic entitlement guaranteed by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, adopted by United Nations in 1948 and associated with the right to file and liberty. In other words, every person has the right without any discrimination to equal protection of the law. Human rights are the basic rights and freedoms that belong to every person in the world from birth until death, without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin. These standards allow all people to live with dignity, freedom, equality, justice, and peace. The significance and ever-evolving interaction between security and human rights is reinforced if we consider the human rights consist of human security, social security and stability, as well as social resilience. And thus, individual, national, and international development requires the protection of human rights. Moreover, we cannot have security without the protection of human rights, as we cannot have human rights without the protection of security. Development requires respect for human rights, and respect for human rights prevents conflicts and violence. So security is part of the human rights. Therefore, from a practical point of view, peacemaking must be built on human rights foundation and peacekeeping. Peace building must likewise give a central place to human rights considerations, as indeed must incorporate human rights strategies. So having said that, see, for example, the ongoing debate in the United States. While citizens are allowed to use guns for self-defense, Guns violence has reached crisis proportion. Nearly 40,000 people are killed yearly by guns in the United States in recent years, and another 175,000 are wounded. Women and individuals of colors are disproportionately affected, while mass shooting occurs with alarming frequency in school, in office, at charges, and concert, and in theaters, and an average of one school shooting occurs every week. Although Americans constitute only 4.4% of the world's population, 42% of civilian-owned guns in the world are found in the US. Research shows that, among others, licensing of gun possession and firearms dealers, safe storage laws, and restriction on the sale and possession of high-capacity and semi-automatic firearms can dramatically reduce firearms homicides, suicides, and accidental death. And thus, although many countries have implemented the strict firearm regulations in response to mass shootings and public safety concerns, and they have uniformly seen reductions in gun violence, the crisis continues to spiral out of control, and the rates of gun death, both homicides and suicides, greatly exceeds those of other industrial nations. The failure of many states of federal and the federal governments to adapt gun safety legislation to prevent gun violence violates a legal obligation to protect human rights of Americans. Responding to the crisis requires getting the political authorities to take human rights seriously and to adapt public health measures addressing the problem. It also requires a cultural shift that is already underway to focus less on gun ownership and more on human rights, and find the appropriate balance between the rights of individual to own a gun and the rights of individual to be safe. Fundamentally, security has to do with the presence of peace and safety, the protection of human and physical resources, or absence of crisis or threats of violence. However, the coronavirus pandemic has dramatically changed the traditional frame of reference for what constitutes a security issue by thrusting a public health challenge center stage as the world's most pressing non-military threat to human security. Rights restrictions and securitization of health in Israel during COVID-19 shows that Israel adopted a series of legal measures that have restricted various human rights, including limitations not only on the right of freedom of movement itself, but also on family life, freedom of assembly, and freedom of religion. And in addition to the various rights restricted because of the limitation and the lockdown, the Israel Security Agency, the ISA, was given an extensive powers to obtain and monitor the location data provided by the mobile phones of each and every citizens in order to prevent or limit the spread of contagion. However, utilizing the technology to combat the pandemic raises significant questions concerning the debate over privacy with regard to monitoring of sensitive personal information. Since the right to privacy was severely limited, the emergency regulations create dangerous precedent that could remain with us long after the COVID-19 is over. So there is a greater risk that the rollout of contact tracing or disease tracking technologies will set a dangerous precedent that is in the long term will infringe on public's rights. The concern is that major historical events can be springboard for attempted wide-scale collection of information and mass surveillance. So to sum up, it is imperative that countries not only officially declare their intentions to balance between the right of security and the basic human rights, but reaffirm their commitments to human rights and take concrete steps to effectively implement conflict prevention and response, particularly due to the dynamic and ever-changing nature and threats to the human security, which has to be balanced with other human rights. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Anna Trofberg-Maron, for the valuable insight. To put it shortly, you were talking about how security and human rights, how deeply they are intertwined, that one is not available without the other. You were talking about the USA as a recent example, and how it is necessary after the impact of the corona pandemic crisis and all the legal obligations that have been set at that time to balance again, to find a new balance again between security and human rights, so that there is no precedent set through this pandemic. Did I get it right?
Yes, correct. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that input.
Thank you.
Let's move on to our next panelist addressing another topic. Magister David Keinrath, representative of Österreichisch-Weißrussische Gesellschaft. Are you with us?
Yes, thank you very much for inviting me. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Perfect. Mr. Keinrath, the well-known Snowden leaks, they exposed the US prison program, which for years monitored leaders and people of many countries, including the European countries. What thoughts should be given to that kind of surveillance program?
Well, you're asking a very important question. And before I start off, I would like to caution that I'm not a lawyer, I'm a political scientist. And in this esteemed panel, I think there are some lawyers, so I have to tread very carefully when I make statements about human rights, right? So your question is very important, and on the surface of it, it appears to be a very American question, because this prison program that you referred to is probably still in force, is a program that was developed by American intelligence agencies for the mass surveillance of entire populations of every aspect of their electronic lives. And this ties very much into what Dr. Hochberg said. It's a sea change. It's a qualitative change in how our societies work. It's not so much a political question of a choice whether we want to live in a free and democratic society, but it's more about how we govern our societies in the face of completely new technological possibilities. So when we talk about Snowden and prison, I would like to compare the new facts which Snowden helped to make known to the broader public. I would like to compare that to the start of the atomic age. We simply have means at our disposal. Some governments in our world have means at our disposal to run and surveil entire societies, which were simply not available before. At the click of a button, you can find out in-depth information about every citizen, for which you in old times would have needed armies of researchers, agents, and so on to find out the exact same information. And I would like to give the Americans a pass here, in the sense that it's not surprising that this kind of program started in the United States, since it's the leading technological power in the world. And it's also not a surprise that similar developments are taking place in China, because it's very close number two. It's leading in so many sectors of the IT industry and infrastructure and so on, artificial intelligence. So it is only logical that these countries who have these technological possibilities, the potential, also utilize it in such a way. And it's a trial and error process. And it ties into human rights in the sense that we need to reinterpret what our traditional interpretation of human rights means in the digital age. Let me just please shortly refer to what Dr. Flam said before. I really liked the provocative thesis of NGOs as tools of power politics. And I would like to tie in just very because this has been part of my reading and of my research as well, and I think it's something that should be considered. So first of all, in many cases, I agree with the thesis of Laszlo. And in the in this context, we should keep in mind that most of the NGOs that we see today, which are active internationally, have a very small mandate. You have to ask yourself, what democratic legitimacy do they have? How large is their member space? How many people are actually actively working for them? And the truth is that most of these organizations have a very small and very professional paid staff. They're not mass organizations, and they receive their fundings from different government agencies and also from private individuals who are usually large donors. And with this structure behind them, so they receive large grants from different organizations and private individuals, and they're very professionalized small cadre organizations. They then go into other countries to promote human rights there. And one might ask, in whose interest are they acting? In whose interest are they acting? It's not always clear. Of course, they don't state it openly. They always refer to universal values, which in some cases might be true or it might not. But the optics of it is very skewed, because I mean, let's be honest. They don't treat every country equally. And human rights violations in some countries seem to get a pass or not so much attention, whereas human rights violations in other countries are being mediatized 24/7. So that's just a little bit of a background to what Laszlo said. Thank you.
Thank you very much. One important point I would say is, what does human right mean in the digital age? So if I understood you right, it means so we need a new discussion and looking for a new definition of maybe of human rights.
I would say interpretation. I mean, the rights should still be the same, but what does it mean in the digital age? Yeah.
Okay, I would like to pose another question. Amid the campaign against COVID-19, in the US, the Floyd incident and the anti-discrimination Asian movement, they have been also hot topics. What human rights issues would you see behind those? What human rights issues are connected to those incidents, would you say?
It's interesting that you ask that question, because this question is actually connected both to human rights and to NGOs, which we're discussing here today. First of all, COVID-19 is a global topic that concerns almost all countries in the world, and it has several human rights issues tied to it. And again, I'm looking at this from a political science perspective, so I'm looking at broader social dynamics. The Floyd incident in the United States, which spawned the Black Lives Matter movement, as well as the anti-Asian violence, which has been surfacing in the United States. I would qualify those as more specific North American or even US problems, and I will get to them later. Okay, so I start with COVID-19. COVID-19 is primarily a health crisis, but the human rights issues that surface are twofold, right? So on the one hand, you have the government restrictions which have been posed on the populations in response to the pandemic. There were lockdowns, so there were limitations on the freedom of movement of people. These lockdowns also had a whole like series of other consequences. For example, the right of education, since in many countries schools were closed and children couldn't follow education in the way they have a right to. There were limitations on how you could dress, and now that vaccines become more readily available, there is also a question about the right to decide about your own body, as in there is a contradiction or a dilemma between the right of the individual to choose what medicine is administered and the safety of the society as a whole to say, please vaccinate in order to not recreate this pandemic, right? So, and the second human rights issue is, of course, the right of access to treatment. And this is one of the more like economic human rights, which especially concerns poorer countries where there are not enough resources available for all citizens to be covered with a good medical treatment, including vaccines. But it is also a question of distribution and fairness in the richer countries where enough resources are available, but still not everybody is covered by the same insurance programs. So in my opinion, these are like the main human rights challenges connected to COVID-19. And when we talk about the restrictions, we always have to ask ourselves, all right, it's clear nobody will doubt that these restrictions that the governments have put on us, they're limitations of our civil rights, of our human rights. And they tell us that, okay, they're temporary and they're proportional to the threat. So somebody please tell me how long is temporary, 5 months, 10 months, 1 year, 2 years, and what is proportional? How many people do you lock up to prevent one preventable death? Is it okay to lock up 10,000 people to prevent the death of one? Is it okay to lock up 1 million people for a month to prevent the death of one? Is it okay to lock up the entire country to prevent the death of one? And for how long? I mean, these are questions that every society needs to ask itself and then make a choice based on what like the values in this society are. And I can imagine that the answer will be different from country to country. Sorry, now I didn't talk about Black Lives Matters and the anti-Asian violence. Would you like me to make two short points about them?
Yeah, please go on.
Okay, so the Black Lives Matters movement is a very interesting phenomenon from the point of view of a European observer, because it highlights problems that have been existing in US society for a long time. Inequality between races in the United States have been a factor of public life for a long time, discrimination and so on, and even the structural violence of the police. It's not something that came overnight. It's been known for a long time. And to me, it is very surprising that it now boiled up exactly at this moment because of one incident, which has been heavily reported upon, which is in any case good to put the spotlight on such a big fundamental problem in United States society. But what surprises me even more is that even in countries where there is nowhere near the same problematic between different sectors of the population, like here in Austria, there were very large protest marches on the streets in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement, even though it had no connection to our country whatsoever, which points towards like this global media reality that people live in nowadays. And the anti-Asian violence is a very important and sometimes overlooked phenomenon. It seems to be like the polar opposite of the BLM movement, right? So both of these problems in the United States are discrimination, racism problems, inequality based on race. But whereas people of color in the United States have a history of being disadvantaged and discriminated against and underachieving, especially in a socioeconomic way, their access to higher education, their access to higher paying jobs is lower than the general population. The story of Asian Americans, especially Northeast Asian Americans, has been quite the opposite. They have been overachieving. The college admission rates of young Asian Americans are higher than the average of than the American average. Their average incomes are higher than the American average, and they have risen very fast. So they have actually had a success story to point towards. And it seems to me then that rather than this structural oppression to push people down, it may have something to do with the jealousy of the economic success that this group in the American society has achieved. So yeah, these are my two short comments. I'm sure there are many, many more comments to make, but I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your very clear and precise input, especially also what we can see when we look at these examples, how biased reporting is sometimes depending on the cultural background and the political priorities. So thank you very much. So we have another speaker before we move on to our second keynote. I would like to welcome now Magister Otto Kölbl. Are you with us? Magister Otto Kölbl, are you here? Can you turn on your mic?
We can. Okay, I thought that you would unmute me, but I think now you hear me.
I hear you, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you can hear me also. Okay, welcome. Mr. Kölbl, you are a scholar as well as an experienced traveler, amongst others, in Tibet. So, as is known, the international community has long been concerned with human rights, with the situation of ethnic minorities in Xinjiang and Tibet. How do you see the situation there? And what is the Chinese government's policy towards these minorities, according to your observation? Would you please share your thoughts with us?
Yes, thank you. So, in order to illustrate this and also in order to make some advertisement for my research methodology, I will try to illustrate this with three concrete issues. So there is in the first place the issue of language related to education. So that's the economic, social and cultural rights emphasized by Dr. Skrubüssel, which are definitely very important in developing countries. And then the link of this with business and economic development in minorities, also economic, social, and cultural rights, and the relationship between this with security, especially in Chinese minority eras. So a topic which was emphasized by Dr. Hochberg. And all this must then be seen, you know, the situation in Tibet in the light of reporting by media and NGOs. And so this is of course linked to the topic of biased reporting emphasized by Dr. Lache Le Flamme and Dr. Keinrad. So that's more or less the topics about which I will talk. I very strongly believe in collecting data on the ground and also in doing some kind of systematic collection of the already published information so that then we can use this in order to analyze media and NGO reporting. The research concept is in the information transmission chain, which means that I try to see what kind of information I can get on the ground, what information I can get, which is already published, and then have a look at what of this information is transmitted by media and NGOs and what is neglected and suddenly disappears and why. So language, education, people who are a little bit familiar with China know that there are schools available in minority eras where either part of education, for example, only the education in the minority language, about the cultural literature, is done in the minority language, or also schools called minority schools, where actually most of education is done in the minority language, and only Chinese courses, the courses specific to learn the Chinese language, are given in Chinese. So this is actually recommended by UN human rights texts. It's probably, we can call it best practice. It has been described in literature media. The question is always, does it work? What's the impact on the ground? So I spent 3 months mainly in Eastern Tibet, trying to work with Tibetans, living with Tibetans without anybody from the Chinese Communist Party being present. So that was not an organized travel. I was really there on my own, working and living with them. And I could see to what extent it works. So definitely it works quite well. I saw many Tibetans. So first of all, when you travel there, what you see is really, especially in the rural areas, you see Tibetans who speak Tibetans. Some speak Chinese, but also some speak English because they came back from years in India. But they speak Tibetan. They live according to Tibetan customs. They live in Tibetan traditional houses. And actually their communities are really structured by the monasteries, which have regained the role they played. So the monasteries have got a huge role in education, in religion, in culture, even in economic development. So that sounds quite good. What are the problems? And also, what is economic development? So there is an interesting mechanism which I saw there and which is hardly ever mentioned, namely Tibetans often don't have traditionally a tradition in, for example, tourism, hospitality sector and so on, which would be now important for economic development. And so what happens is that when a region gets opened by infrastructure, which is extremely important and generally demonized by NGOs, but the Tibetans really want this infrastructure to be built up, then you get an influx of Han and Hui Chinese who start the economic development. They create small businesses. And then after some 10 years, the Tibetans, after often working for these entrepreneurs, start to take over to create their own businesses, and very often start to push the initial builders of the economic development, the Han and Hui Chinese, out of business because they are locals, they have got certain advantages like master the control over the land and things like this. And so this really is very encouraging. Problem, of course, number one maybe is when as a Westerner, you try to help them, for example, trying to import the Swiss mountain biking tourism, which could really produce a big boom in Tibet, for example, the Tibetan areas, you get attacked massively by Western NGOs and activists who don't want this, who consider you a kind of stooge of the Communist Party. So there is really a problem, an issue of this Western NGO reporting, which does create problem and destroys potential in Tibet. There are, of course, other positive and negative aspects in Tibet itself. So of course, it's often a question of civilization and culture. For example, the prestige of formal education in Tibet is very high, but only if it's related to religion and culture. People who want to do business very often don't get help, even from, for example, people with good literacy. And many entrepreneurs actually are illiterate. And in China, this is not necessarily a problem, because really, business, small entrepreneurs in China is often done in closed business communities where you don't do any kind of written contracts. So rule of law, you can forget about it, but it works really well. It's probably more efficient in order to help minorities emerge and create their own businesses than if you have this complex rule of law where newcomers often don't have a chance. And that's very often what we see here in Western countries where small businesses get squeezed out of business by this horrendous complexity of rule of law, administration, and so on. So all this generally is not really, our media and NGOs don't inform well about this and don't provide us with the information which we need in order to have a positive impact in Tibet. But now, if that works quite well in Tibet, so yeah, I mean, why are there tensions? I mean, in Tibet in the 1950s, there was a huge armed insurgency, which has done a lot of damage and has led to the massive destruction of monasteries. And now, of course, Xinjiang. So why is there what we can call a beginning of an armed insurrection?
Excuse me, Mr. Koebel, I just have to take a close look at the time left for the other panelists. Okay. Is there a possibility that you just round up your main messages in like 1 minute, something like that, so that all the other panelists have also a chance?
Sure. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I thought I was short, but yeah, I always...
I understand that very clearly.
And so why... armed insurrections actually in Asia, and this is well documented, but it doesn't get spread in the media. There are armed insurgencies virtually in every single country where there are minorities. And so we must ask ourselves why. And then, okay, China tries out a new approach with these vocational training camps and with massive surveillance. The alternative is simply, yeah, what do we want? An armed insurrection with tens of thousands of deaths over many decades. They try something new. So we should try to see what are the reasons instead of simply blanking, condemning. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your reflections and your insight, and also the role, which you pointed out, the role of biased reporting about situations. Thank you very much for that input. We have now our second keynote speaker. It's our keynote speaker, but it's his second term, Professor Guzel. And in order to further broaden our topic, he is now going to share with us reflections upon the following question. In the course of protecting human rights, double standard issues by some NGOs have been observed, and we have mentioned that topic already in today's considerations. How do you see the role of NGOs in better serving the future of human civilization? You have another 10 minutes for your second keynote. Please, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much again. So, let's begin. The Secretary General of the UN, Antonio Guterres, in 2017, in the 13th session of the Human Rights, ask for human rights in an impartial way without double standards and recognize human rights as a values and goes onto themselves, not allowing them to be instrumentalized as a political tool. And Alfred Tesayas, the first UN independent expert on the promotion of a democratic and equitable international order, I'm happy that he is my friend as well, stated that the weaponization of human rights has transformed the individual and collective entitlement to assistance, protection, respect, and solidarity based on our common human dignity and equality into a hostile arsenal to target competitors and political adversaries. In the stop bill of weaponized human rights, the technique of naming and shaming has become a sort of Kalashnikov. According to Alfred Tesayas, naming and shaming fails to alleviate the sufferings of the victims and only satisfies the strategic aims of certain governments, politicized non-governmental organizations, and human rights in that tree that instrumentalize human rights for the purpose of establishing others and often enough to facilitate regime change. Regardless of anti-democratic that may fall, and notwithstanding the customary international law principle of non-intervention in the internal affairs of foreign states. And in the quest for power and influence of states after the establishment of the UN, human rights discourse has become a valuable source. And today, human rights become an industry based on so-called non-governmental organizations, which are almost financed by state. And so for the fund, we say them as GONGOS, that is governmental, non-governmental organizations are established for the fabrication of a project to achieve political goals of the state. For the regime changement, even to regime changement. But also I should mention from my own experience inside the UN, and they are the members of ECOSOC, There are Tongos, these are the terrorist organized non-governmental organization, and they are being used for their political goals. And they are inside the UN as well. And for example, pro-LGBT groups, they can say that they are freedom fighters, and they can say it inside the UN, inside the side meetings, but LGBT made ethnic cleansing to the Sri Lanka Muslims. And no impunity can be given for an ethnic cleansing crime. This is crime for impunity, and they want some Sri Lanka Muslims to go on. And this is an interesting relation. Other than Tongos, sometimes the people who are formed by the NGOs. I mean, when I'm working on Myanmar Rohingya issue, there is an interesting issue. There is a very small Christian Rohingya community in the refugee camps in Bangladesh. And because they are Christian, they were attacked, kidnapped, and their church were burned. And they were never supported by the Muslim Rohingya Christian human rights defenders for a very, very long time, who are refugees in the Christian countries, and they refuse them. So human rights becomes a really dirty business for the political goals of the others. And when we come to the civil society of weaknesses of human society, as well affect the NGOs and the society. And most of the time, prejudice controls not only humans, also the societies. The civil society members most of the times being affected politically and psychologically. And this is a dilemma to achieve a better common future for the human civilization. And one of the most important obstacles to achieve a better future for humanity is Orientalism, unfortunately. Many Western civil society members, even they are not Gongos, believe that human rights is a problem only in non-Western countries. Oriented from the concept of colonization, originated from the legitimization of bringing civilization to uncivilized world, these are happy to believe that only non-Western governments can be the non-violators. And when one non-Western civil society member mentions any human rights violations of the Western governments, such as Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, etc., for the Western civil society members, this is only a kind of non-enforcement based on necessity, but they never give tolerance to something like this to a non-Western country. And when we are asking for impunity for the gross violation of human rights abuses, and when we come to the political realism, we can see that right and justice apply only to the relation among two equals in power. For the others, the strong do what they can, and the weak suffer what they must. And when we see the practice of the International Criminal Court today, the ICC was designated as a court of last resort for anti-impunity. But there's a growing perception that an institute of international criminal justice needs to protect vulnerable people from brutal national rulers has been subverted into an instrument of powerful against vulnerable countries. Africans are being held to international accountability for domestic criminal acts. But Westerners and those reliant on them for protection from the reach of international crime, criminal justice, escape accountability for international acts of possible war crimes. And this Orientalism approach of the civil society members of the Western society is giving birth to its own opposite, which creates an endless circle between two different societies. And it, of course, it's the crash of the civilization in a way. And one legitimization is being used for the wrongful actions of the state on regional centralization. This legitimization goes on micro level to far right nationalism when the regional arena begins to become smaller. But why the human rights are weaponized? In fact, all these wrongs show how important the NGOs are to humanity. NGOs are the symbol of the soft power to achieve big achievements. I mean, to achieve a better future of human civilization, in fact, we only have the NGOs, whatever the others try to be used. The main reason behind this is that the history of the mankind changed in the name of humanity in the last century proves that after only the great human tragedies, the state can only take action. And let's remember the equality of the people. I mean, for the first time after the Second World War, that human beings are accepted equal by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And after the establishment of the United Nations, colonization becomes a crime. and after the establishment of Yuan conquests its orbit.
I'm very sorry, we have such a tight schedule. Is it possible that you wrap up your message in one sentence so that I can sum it up? Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt, but yeah, we are running out of time.
Angels are the soft power who works continuously and without a human tragedy can achieve big things for humanity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your input. Just to sum it up, human rights, there is a human right industry already. There are some problematic aspects of NGOs as they are often trapped in the prejudices and the difference between how our Western societies are judged and how our non-Western societies are judged. But nevertheless, NGOs are necessary because of their soft power, more effective and less corrupt. Is that okay? Thank you very much for that input. Let's move on to Dr. Ernst Löschner from Alpine Peace Crossing Austria. Are you here? Can you hear me? Your microphone is on. Dr. Löschner?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you.
There is one question in connection to the remarks of Professor Güzel. We believe the most challenging goal of NGOs is to promote the progress of human rights worldwide. The question is, should human rights achieve its goal by being bound to unilateral economic, social, and political norms rather than by taking into consideration the historical and cultural context in the different regions? So would you please take your 5 minutes time and point out your main messages for all our participants? Thank you.
Well, thank you for inviting me, first of all. This is a very challenging question that you have put to me. It's not an either or. The question is, should there be norms in for NGOs in promoting human rights, or is it not more necessary to include the historical and cultural context in trying to come up with actions and solutions? The norms and I was very interested in the comment of Benedict Flam there with his new value categories. Mm-hmm. I believe norms are necessary and useful also in terms of communication. And there I was also very interested in the comments of David Kainrad and Otto Kolber. They spoke about language. Norms like being even-handed, listening to the other, respect the other. These are norms that I believe are very important and should be universal. Having said this, I'm totally convinced that without taking due notice and appreciation and an understanding of the historical and cultural context in different regions, it's impossible to achieve a peaceful solution to any conflict. It's the same within families. Unless you listen to each other, try to understand each other, and especially, of course, when there are different mentalities and different cultures involved, prejudices, all these have a reason. Why did they emerge? And it is very important in listening to each other and expressing each other openly and honestly. Only in that way progress can be achieved. But they can never be unilateral, nor unilateral approaches. They have to be multilateral. Having said this is a general answer, let me also mention something that will perhaps surprise you all. when I grew up, and we had our children, we have four of them, they're of course all grown and with grandchildren around. I'm 78 now. When I grew up and we had our first children, there was a book called Children the Challenge by an Austrian Jewish author who published and researched in the United States, Rudolf Dreikurs. And this came to mind now as I approached your question. And I will just point out two or three things that I believe apply very much whenever we consider how could we achieve a better living together and ideally peace regionally and globally. First of all, listening is the key. Another advice: do the unexpected, especially when it's a head-on conflict, and especially the historical and cultural backgrounds, they create emotions. And when there are negotiations, it's often very, very emotional. And then out of the emotion, attacks come, and then often the discussion is stopped. That's the end. And doing the unexpected is perhaps answering to someone who's very emotional, saying, gee, you know, I haven't thought of that. Yes, your emotions, they're very strong, and perhaps you're right. I have not addressed these emotions, have not fully understood the background to all that. Another thing, another message is don't shoot flies with elephants. Be proportionate in your response. Anyway, I will not go on. Let me briefly, and I will be cognizant of the time, to explain my approach to human rights and to world peace. This, I don't know if you can see that here. This is our logo, Alpine Peace Crossing. And if you're interested, of course, we have a website. If you put in Alpine Peace, you get everything. I stumbled on a totally forgotten chapter of post-war Austrian history, which was a Jewish exodus over the Austrian Alps in 1947. It was always reported there were 5,000. Meanwhile, I can prove there were 8,000 of them. After the war, they came from Eastern Europe, mostly Poland, but also Romania, Uzbekistan, elsewhere. They could not stay there any longer because of the anti-Semitism continuing also after the war. There was a terrible pogrom in Kielce in Poland. There was the Polish exodus. 200,000 came to Austria, and then eventually many of them, of course, didn't know where to go. You all know the story of exodus. No country wanted any Jews. So the old Herzl dream of Palestine reaching the promised land fortunately became a reality. And for many of them, and 8,000 of them had to cross the Alps, which to me is a symbol of determination. When people are desperate, no fence is big enough, no mountain is high enough for humans not to do everything to reach that goal. This is what, when I discovered that, and this is where I now come to what contributions an NGO could make, I realized I'm not Jewish myself, but I'm a friend of I have many Jewish friends. I have many Arab friends. I realized that I must not just listen and learn about it. It was totally forgotten. I grew up in that area, and I decided it must not remain forgotten. And in 2007, I organized the first commemorative march over the Alps. Okay, I sum it up in one final minute.
Please.
All right, because you can
have another
you can get it everything from the homepage.
Yeah.
What is the contribution that an NGO such as ours can make? We can create awareness, and we can we don't over-exaggerate our potential. We are a forum of dialogue. That's our strongest big dialogue, creating awareness. And also, we don't provide answers. As a forum of dialogue, we let others get together and talk about possible solutions. But we have beliefs and we express them. We created a grove of light with trees dedicated to the refugees today. This is what is the link that we saw from the very beginning. And we have refugees from Tibet, we have refugees from Chechnya, from Afghanistan, from Syria. And they also pay their respects to what was the fate of the Jews. And the final message that I want to say, it's we try also to give a signal of hope, because the Jews of 1947 who crossed, none of them was hurt. They were all had their fears, but eventually they reached a new home, a new land. And this is the message that we believe we can convey. And with peace pyramids around the world now, both in Eastern Europe and where they then eventually went, we believe with these small symbols, we can make people reflect and become more aware, and perhaps build in that way an international or more international community of empathy, of compassion. Thank you.
I think respect is the most important term you mentioned. So that it's not either a norm or the cultural context, it's both. And the most important point is respect and empathy, I think. Yeah. Thank you very much for your contribution and your insight into your initiative with this very interesting historical background. We have two more contributions on our schedule. So let's move on to Dr. Annette Hochberg-Maron. You've been with us before already. So I take now the liberty to ask you to convey your message maybe in only like a couple of minutes. For example, 4 would be a wonderful time. The question we were thinking about was about the US, in the USA, those Blackwater employees who have been pardoned for their crimes they have committed in Iraq. And how would you interpret this in terms of human rights? Is there a double standard behind it or not? How would you comment on that event?
Sure, I do it very quick. And I would say that the act against personal property, war crimes, constitute the serious violations of law, as laws of war, that gives rise to individual criminal responsibility. Clearly, the 4 Blackwater employees who committed war crimes in Iraq and pardoned by the former US President Donald Trump violated the human rights of the Iraqi people. This action manifests his, President Trump, disrespect toward the Iraqi people's human rights. And as such, it is a prominent instance for the blatant hypocrisy behavior and double standards attitude of the US and Trump administration. Generally speaking, the gap between professed values and actual American policy is especially evident outside the Western world. US officials routinely criticize Iraq, Syria, Iran, not only for their external behavior, but for the manifestation of domestic abuse and repression. Some of those criticisms are valid, but the credibility of Washington's expression of outrage is vitiated when those officials remain silent or even excuse equally serious and in some cases more egregious abuses than the United States and its allies commit. Trump administration came to office signaling a desire to shake up diplomatic norms. In his inaugural address, Trump assured listeners that no longer would the United States seek to impose its way of life on anyone. Moreover, he has not only avoided the proactive promote human rights, but rather ignored the human rights violation. Ironically, some foreign observers praise the new administration's nationalistic approach as more honest than its predecessor, especially when contrasted with the uneven and often counterproductive record of American democracy promotion. But in practice, this liberal attitude has meant a worrisome gravitations to autocrats. Trump has praised leaders from Russia, Saudi Arabia, the Philippines, and even North Korea, while disdaining traditional allies. I would skip some example, but what I wanted to say that yet President Trump and other US officials express little criticism of those brutal autocratic allies. Moreover, Washington has continued to provide military assistance for Saudi Arabia and Emirati campaigns in Yemen, despite the legendary human rights abuses and the increased concern by United Nations officials that coalition attacks against civilians might amount to war crimes. And I've gave some example that reflecting the double standards and hypocrisy of Trump administration in respect to violent human rights. And indeed, the double standards policy demonstrate to abuse of power by the superpower. Unlike the pardoning of American citizens who committed war crimes in Iraq, citizens of former Yugoslavia, Cambodia, and African states were tried and convicted by the international court. Ironically, the leading democracy in the world is internationally defying and mocking its liberal ideology, which is at the same time being applied on the American public. So therefore, the international community should not prosecute criminals from non-powerful countries, but also put pressures on the powerful US to stop and avoid double standards policy and be intolerant towards human rights violation worldwide. Thank you. And I did it very, very quick.
Thank you very much for that input. It's another example of what we have heard today several times, the bias judging if there is a human right topic in a Western society or in a non-Western society. And also important what you mentioned, promoting the human rights, but ignoring human rights violations. So these are two very important inputs, I think. Thank you very much. To round up our inputs, I'm a bit running out of time, but we have one comment left. This is Hermann Kreuer from UNCAF. UNCAF is United Nations Correspondents Association Vienna. And I would like him to ask for a contribution to explain what is exactly the role of your organization played in the context of the United Nations in serving the cause of humanity. And do you see problems in protecting the human rights under the international humanitarian law? Are you with us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah, I can hear you too.
Yeah.
Please provide your input in concluding our forum.
So first of all, thank you so much for your invitation. I make it as short as possible. First of all, description UNCAF, who we are. We see ourselves as an independent organization not bound to any political, religious, or economic institutions, which acts in the spirit of the United Nations in a way that brings people together and is internationally networked. The Association of United Nations Correspondents in Vienna was founded on the 27th of February 1985 in Vienna, which is current headquarters in the UNO city, Vienna. At that time, UNCAF consisted mainly of accredited representatives of national media at the UN, as well as Austrian media representatives. Today, we have over 250 members from different countries and continents. Due to the crucial role and growing influence of the United Nations in the world, the number of correspondents also grew. Staff journalists of the print media, editors, part-time media representatives, press photographers, staff of embassies and missions based in Austria, writers, publicists, interpreters, translators, and other supporters have worked closely together from the very beginning, pursuing and promoting their professional interests and reporting UN authorities and Vienna. And now our goals in a few words. UNCAF supports journalists in their activities to create the conditions for everyone to participate in the process of opinion forming by providing a comprehensive range of information by critically accompanying social and political life. We want to combine solidarity-based action with the representation of professional interests. We want freedom of the press for all those working in the media and are committed to the code of honor for the Austrian press. This is a principle of journalistic work. Mm-hmm. We are an organization that implements the conscience of its members quickly and competently. UNCA sees itself as a service provider, a community of solidarity, and a social meeting point, as well as a hub for journalists and the UN. The association lives from the activity of its members, especially from the voluntary work of its members. And at least UNCTA will continue to develop and improve, and we are looking for input from members and experts. We will do our best to accommodate the conscience of our members. With the inclusion of the United Nations in our name, we have also taken a special responsibility and obligation with regard to our work and seriousness and our dealings with partners and the public. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that input. So you are working strongly in the context of the United Nations, independent of political, religious, and economic institutions. So that's the basic framework for the UNCA work also. Thank you very much. We are now coming to an end, and for summing up our online forum on the role of NGOs in the course of human civilization, I would like to invite one of the organizers, Magister Bernd Müller from Urban Forum, and it's a non-profit association in Austria. And I would like to invite him to close up our forum and to suggest some concluding thoughts on the discussions we heard today. Are you here?
Yes, I'm here. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, perfect.
Thank you for the floor. I will give the summary in only some sentences and in a few minutes. At first, I would like to say I agree with Professor Güssel that NGOs will be even more important in the future. He already referred to the historical merits of NGOs in the preparation for today's forum, thankfully mentioning the anti-slavery movement and the Red Cross. So I think the range of NGOs is much wider than it would seem at first glance. It seems important to me to emphasize that NGOs are, as the name suggests, non-governmental organizations. Therefore, in my opinion, the commitment to civil society and to the key points such as human rights must be in the foreground. NGOs must not allow themselves to be instrumentalized. They have to remember their origins, why they were founded. If they follow these basic rules, they are indispensable in civil society. Then soft power becomes hard power, I think so. But I also see another problem. NGOs need money and attention. Repressive states can deny them both. NGOs are therefore easily blackmailed and quickly fall into dangerous dependencies because NGOs can easily be pressured regarding their funding. So they sometimes tend to attract attention with, I would like to say, flashy actions. Let's think of Greenpeace. But such marketing gags are often bad for respectability. We therefore need not only serious NGOs, but also an informed population that supports and appreciates their actions. We will still have a lot of educational work ahead of us. And my last sentence, I would like to say it in the words of the former president of Austria, Heinz Fischer. In a conference not so long ago, he said, "In the Western countries, we should see that social rights can be also human rights." And I would like to say in my own words, a life without hunger and sickness should be as important as the well-known human rights. Thank you for the floor. thank you for participating. It was a great honor for Sinopress and for Urban Forum. And the inputs and the comments were very interesting and very helpful. And thank you for the wonderful moderation. And this conference is recorded and finished.
Thank you very much, Magister Müller, for summing up, for pointing out the main issues concerning the future role of NGOs. I myself would like to thank the organizers, Urban Forum and Sinopress, for providing us with the opportunity to discuss such an important topic. A transcript of today's discussion will be available, and as far as I know, Urban Forum and Sinopress will keep you updated on any further and upcoming events. Yeah, for the sake of today's events and topics, some short video clips have been collected from official sources. So please take a couple of 2 or 3 minutes just in fading out of the forum and watch the videos that have been prepared. Thank you very much for all your contributions and have a good day. Auf Wiedersehen.